Hello and welcome to Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 19 for October 6, 2009. My name is Ben Snetkoff, and with me today we've got
Dominic Rabier
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. First off, can you copyright movie times? Second, some game developers move to cancel a trademark over the word edge as it relates to video games. And finally, the first sale doctrine and copyright misuse as it relates to sale of computer programs, and we'll explain that last one. We'll explain all of these more in depth, but specifically what any of the words in that last teaser meant as we get to that story. So first off, we've got whether or not you can copyright movie times. The background behind this story is that a developer tried to, he wanted to make a product that would get movie times from a website and, you know, publish them through his own product. He found one site, movieshowtimes.com, that had a undocumented API. He got into the API, figured out how it worked, and sent an email asking them if he could use this undocumented API, and got quite a nasty response back, essentially saying that, well, let me quote from it, "You need to know that it is unlawful and a violation of our copyright and intellectual property rights for you to build a system that obtains our content from any source other than to obtain an express license from World West Media for legal use of our content. Each violation of our intellectual property rights allows us to collect damages of up to $150,000 per infringement. This would equate to liquid damages of over $600,000 per month if you violate our rights." He went on to ask if, you know, what exactly they meant, and got a very snippy response about how it's not their job to explain intellectual property rights to this guy. So I guess my first question for the panel is, can you copyright a movie time?
Well, first of all, it seems like they've got really friendly lawyers. But no, you can't copyright a movie time, assuming it's a publicly available piece of information that is just a fact. You can't copyright facts.
Okay. I guess just to spin this out for the readers, why can't you copyright a fact?
Because then if you had the protection of copyright law for facts, then no one would be able to reproduce those facts without your permission, which means whoever copyrighted the facts first would reap all the rewards, which would kind of be weird, because it's not like people create these facts all by themselves. Now, that, of course, only applies to facts about the real world. Obviously, facts about invented universes or authors can copyright all the facts they want about their characters, and those are copyrighted, as some J.K. Rowling and Harry Potter cases have demonstrated. But for really real world, like for news, facts of that variety, you can't copyright that because it's part of the shared commonality of human existence. and basically, it's everyone's property, so it doesn't make sense to give one person the right to profit off of it.
Right. To quote from the Copyright Act specifically, this is 17 U.S.C. 102, copyright protection subsists in original works of authorship fixed in any tangible medium of expression. So essentially, a fact just isn't an original work of authorship. It's just a fact. There's got to be, you know, some modicum of creativity in something for it to be copyrightable.
Now, that being said, you can obtain copyright protection for sometimes the arrangement of facts. One of the classic cases has usually dealt with whether or not you could copyright entries into a phone book, because it's factual information of the public record where somebody might live and what their phone number might be. Now, how courts have approached it is, what they say is that while the facts themselves might not be copyrightable, if you arrange them in an original enough fashion, that might be enough to satisfy the originality requirement under the Copyright Act.
Right, and that would require something more than just putting them in alphabetical order, say. So alphabetical order isn't particularly original or novel, but something like arranging them by traits of the people's lawn. Let's say you were doing a directory of who lived in the neighborhood, and you arranged them by, you know, trees they had on their lawn. That may be sufficiently original to warrant copyright protection.
It would have to be really, really original, I think, when you're talking about arrangement of facts.
Right.
You know, something beyond, like you mentioned, alphabetical order, or doing it by, say, locale or city or geographic location or whatever.
The other thing that you can get copyright protection for is, let's say it's not specifically how they're arranged, but if there's a lot of design that goes into the page. So if it's a very ornate, say, yellow pages, you may be able to get copyright protection, not over the facts inside them, but, you know, the design of the page. And
right.
I want to stress that this would have to be like, you know, the illuminated manuscripts where you've got like the first letter of every page with, you know, birds fanning out from it. That's the kind of thing you'd have to do to be able to get protection off of over this.
Right. And like you mentioned, it's not the facts themselves that would be copyrighted. It's just the arrangement and the design elements. So if you had to rearrange, say, a phone book so that it was organized in some really creative way, that particular arrangement would be protected, but still the underlying facts would not. So in other words, you couldn't reproduce the arrangement as it appeared in that original phone book, but you certainly could reproduce the facts.
Right. So what protection then can somebody like, say, Craigslist? Craigslist does this all the time. Somebody will try to make some sort of aggregator that will prevent Craigslist, an aggregator that will search all of the Craigslist. You know, I live in Boston, and I can search Craigslist Boston, and then I can sign out of Craigslist Boston and sign into Craigslist New York City and do a search in Craigslist New York City. But when people try to make search engines that can search all of the different Craigslist databases, they get shut down by Craigslist. Why can Craigslist do that? Because all people are doing there, all my aggregator would be doing is publishing facts or publishing things that, at the very least, Craigslist doesn't have any type of copyright in, because that copyright is owned by the people who posted them.
Well, those aren't so much facts as stuff that Craigslist publishes. And Craigslist has a license, I believe, according to their license agreement, that allows for them to publish those listings. And they shut it down because they have the right to reproduce it, and you don't.
Right. To expand on that, I think what Dominic means is that when people are submitting content to Craigslist, they're agreeing to some sort of implicit license or an express license on the Craigslist site that allows Craigslist to republish their information. And so any original expression that anyone types in and submits to Craigslist, they would have a copyright. And they would need, or Craigslist would need, the authority to be able to republish them. And so since only those two parties, only Craigslist and the person that's submitting the content, are in privity together, no other person who is visiting the website, just some third party that comes around, would necessarily have the same license to reproduce the content. But as far as I know, Craigslist has not made any specific legal challenges. I have heard of several cases where they have made, or through just means of technology, they have stopped the use of any kind of third-party aggregators to the site, because I know there have been a number of them.
Right. There have been cases, though, where there has been, say, some sort of API available, but there are restrictions on the use of that API. Do either of you, I can't think of the names of the cases right now, but do you remember cases where there is an API that's been published, and the people use the API, automate it, get data from that API, and republish it?
Yes, there was a Vario v. the registrar case, I think. I'm pulling this out off the top of my head, but
right.
it involved the Whois queries for domain name registrants, and some spammer. Again, I'm not reading this from the case. I'm trying to recall this off of memory, but someone was using the search query functions on the Whois site to scrape the information out of the Whois results for domain name registrants, and then was using that information to solicit them with advertisements or spam them, basically. And there was a terms of service agreement that was in place on the website which governed the use of making search queries. I don't know that that was as much of an API case as it was just a general terms of service case, but I suppose you could frame that in a number of different ways.
Okay, but this is one way that, I mean, so we've already established that this company's claim to copyright over these is dubious, but there are still other remedies. If the person violated that contract, there could be a remedy at contract.
Right. So assuming that there is some sort of terms of service agreement in place to the use of that proprietary information, being the data of the movie times themselves, you could have a remedy there for a breach of contract. However, though, I've been through both of these sites pretty thoroughly, and on both the movieshowtimes.com and Westworld site as well, I could not find any terms of service agreement in place that was visible on the site. So that I don't know what that exactly means in this case, but it might mean something.
Okay. There is one last kind of, I guess, cause of action here that I'd like to talk about. Say that I have one of these services where I publish factual data, and I have a license agreement that says you're not allowed to, you know, get information from my site without either my permission or, you know, some sort of licensing scheme, and you guys end up pinging my site so often to get this stuff that it actually causes some sort of physical damage to my hardware. And again, this is in violation of the license agreement. Could I also bring a trespass to chattels claim there?
Yes.
Okay, and David, could you just explain to us briefly what trespass to chattels is?
Trespass to chattels is a claim under property law, essentially, that says that someone who does not have the right to possess and use a particular type of property is causing some sort of damage to it. You mentioned that it had to be physical damage to the actual hardware. That's not so much the case. I mean, I think it's just an argument of semantics, but the damage can be just the hindrance to the network itself, not necessarily that the hardware is physically damaged so that it becomes inoperable or something along those lines.
Right, but it would have to be substantial. It can't just be that you accessed it.
No, it wouldn't have to be some sort of transient access. It would have to be that it's become so encumbering to the server itself or to the network or possibly even the website software. And to the extent that the owner of that server or website, you know, is suddenly finds himself in a position where it's not functioning as it should.
Right. So in traditional trespass law, when we're talking about trespass to land, even if you walk onto my property, I can get some measure of damages from whoever it is walked onto my property. But with trespass to chattels, there actually has to be some sort of physical damage, some sort of loss of value. And when the courts first started coming by these trespass cases, when it came to computers, they decided that, yes, it was not appropriate to say that your bits trespassing on my network was enough to... merely your bits trespassing onto my network was not enough to warrant some sort of damages. Anybody have any thoughts on this story, Dominic?
Just to build on that last point in terms of trespass to chattel, here, obviously, they didn't actually do anything to damage their servers. The amount of use wasn't high enough to actually cause any damage. What I find most interesting here is apparently he was using an undocumented API application programming interface function that had just left open, which is kind of odd. And he kindly asked their permission, hey, guys, I noticed you've got this function on your website. Is it all right if I use it? And instead of just being say, oops, no, sorry, we need to detect, we tabled it now, thanks for letting us know, they were like, excuse us while we unleash the lawyers on you.
That is a very curious point, too, and I don't understand why this API was left open, especially if they didn't want to have access to these to the data itself. Now, just to, if I could step away from that point, though, for a second and talk about this lovely nasty gram that was sent by the lawyers and their claim to copyright, it's so vaguely worded, I think, that it's a little bit unclear what they are claiming copyright over, and it could be the case that just accessing the API by itself might constitute some sort of proprietary software, and that might fall under the copyright, so they're finding that to be the use of that API to be a violation of copyright, or they could actually mean the movie times themselves. So, and this could just be like a standard nasty legal letter that they send out whenever somebody accesses something that they don't want to. They haven't made any substantive legal claims yet. They have not filed a complaint or anything like that. So they haven't articulated a particular cause of action for the requested use of this data, but that's all we have here is this vague letter.
Right, and this just dawned on me. They claim that they can get up to damages of $150,000 per violation, and I haven't looked this up, but am I right that that is that's the statutory damages for willful violation of copyright?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, and you can only get statutory damages for registered copyright. So they're either implying that, as you, David, said, that somehow use of this API is a violation of their copyright, which I think is a stretch, or secondarily, that they have registered copyrights in movie times, which would get absurdly expensive and would not be worth it.
Well, again, they've worded this so vaguely, it just says each violation of our intellectual property rights allows us to collect damages up to $150,000. So they're not really saying one way or another whether there's actual registered copyrights here or some other form of protected intellectual property. It seems to me that they're merely saying this is as bad as it gets, and this is why you don't want to do it, trying to sort of scare somebody a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, either way, they made it on the front page of TechDirt, which wins no one friends. Any last thoughts before we move on to the next story?
Nope.
Dominic, you good?
We're all set.
Okay.
I'm good.
So the next story we've got is this surfaced a little while ago. I don't remember the last time this came up. I think it was in conjunction with a program that had to be pulled from Apple's
It was the Mopi Games Edge application.
Right. So there is a company that claims to own the word Edge as it relates to own a trademark in the word Edge as it relates to video games. And EA, Electronic Arts, and Swedish Mirror's Edge developer, DICE, followed a trademark dispute September 10th against Edge Games, challenging this trademark. So, Dominic or David, is one of you more familiar with this story?
A little bit, yeah, but if Dominic has something, go right ahead.
Sure. Basically what happened in this case is that App Store takedown of the game Edge kind of brought this to attentions of bigger guns, such as Electronic Arts, who had actually been negotiating with the owner of the Edge trademark over EA's title Mirror's Edge. And they basically, this sort of pushed it over the edge in the sense that the International Game Developers Association called a special meeting, and they all got together to say, all right, well, what's going on with this Edge trademark? Because this is not the first time, in fact, this is not the second time, but this is at least the third time someone's run into this Edge trademark, and it's kind of silly at this point because it's just the word Edge, right? We're all game developers here. We can work this out like gentlemen. Apparently, that was not the case. And so EA and the developer DICE of the Mirror's Edge game filed actual trademark dispute to say that, hey, this trademark should be canceled because we don't think it's a valid trademark.
Right. I don't know if we've ever run down exactly what a trademark is on this podcast. Can you guys remember a case when we've done this?
I have a feeling we talked a little bit about this when the other application in the iTunes store, or I'm sorry, the application store came out.
Okay, so in that case, let me just do a really brief thing. A trademark is something, at least at federal law, there are also state analogies to analogs to trademark law. You get it under one of two circumstances: when you have actually used a term as a way of branding an actual item. And the way you can tell if it's branding an item if it answers the question of where do I come from, not what I am. So Honda Accord. Honda is where do I come from? It comes from Honda. Although Accord is also trademarked, but that's a different story. And essentially, you can either get it if you have used it, or you can also file what's called an intent to use application. One of you going to jump in?
Nope, keep going.
Sorry, I thought I heard something. You can file what I was saying was an intent to use application, where you say, I'm filing for protection of this word, or this series of words, or this logo, because I intend to use these in commerce, and I want people to be on notice that I'm going to be using these words as a way of branding my product. Now, in this case, rather than just filing like a typical trademark lawsuit, you know, for infringement, what EA and DICE are doing is they're actually filing for what's called cancellation of the mark. They're saying that the company, Langell's company,
Edge Games.
Edge Games is the company, yeah. Actually obtained these trademarks fraudulently because the trademarks were not used in commerce. They weren't used on some of the products that they cited when they were trying to get these trademarks. David or Dominic, what are your thoughts on this? You know, So, Dominic, is this the type of thing that we run into often?
No, it's not something you see very often, just because trademarks, if you file them, the trademark office publishes them, and then after 5 years, they get what's called basically incontestability, saying that no one's bothered to complain about this trademark for 5 years, so I guess it's incontestable because clearly, if someone had a problem with it, they would have noted, but noticed it within 5 years and dealt with it. The reason you don't usually see this happen is just because in order to prove a trademark, to cancel a trademark, you have to go back and show all the stuff that was used to substantiate the trademark being used in commerce, showing that this was actively used. You have to go back and find evidence to show that this all didn't happen or was faked or just was improperly documented. And that's what they've actually done in this case. And there's a blog in the show notes that details this in pretty excruciating detail that goes back and points out all the uses of their trade magazine, that, all this sort of stuff where they said they used this, they didn't use this. And that's what you need to do to cancel a trademark. But the amount of work and the necessity of canceling, as well as the incontestability that applies in court, that basically says, unless you have a ton of evidence, this is not going away, is why you don't see these actions very often.
Right, just to clarify one point, and you made that was an excellent summary too. There's two separate things that have to deal with incontestability. After 5 years, you have the ability to file for incontestability, which means that you actually have to submit an affidavit to the USPTO. But if you don't do that after 5 years, you actually do get some very limited but incontestability-like protection, which only allows somebody to challenge the mark on grounds of either being generic, functional, whether it was abandoned, or whether there was some sort of fraud in registration.
And do you
Now,
have the statute in front of you, so just you can give the listeners that cite?
well, the title is under 15 USC.
Okay, and all of the Lanham Act is somewhere around Section 1051,
Right.
generally. Okay, that's good enough for now.
Somewhere in the 1100s, probably, but I'd have to go back and check. And let's see here. I'm not really sure if, and maybe Dominic, you know better than I, whether or not Edge Games had actually filed for incontestability or whether this was just the 5 year point where you have limited grounds to challenge the validity of the mark itself. I don't know if this was actually, if Edge Games actually filed for incontestability because this is an action for fraud and registration, and I don't think that you can challenge for fraud and registration actually after you filed for incontestability. I'd have to go back and double check that, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
That's pretty rough if that's the case.
It is, and that's why in that 5 year period, it's so important that if you have somebody that's going to challenge the validity of a mark, that they go ahead and do so. So I don't think what we have talked about here is what the marks that are at issue actually are. And there are three, it appears, that are subject to this filing, which include the mark The Edge, Gamer's Edge, and Cutting Edge, all of which are marks that have been registered by the company Gamer's Edge.
Okay, so I guess, which marks are those? Are those the marks? Those aren't the marks that are trying to be con. I guess my question is, who's Gamer's Edge, the company then? Is that.
That's Langdell's company. So
Okay.
we haven't really talked very much about Tim Langdell either and why this is a little bit controversial. Tim Langdell has been sort of criticized by the media for being a trademark troll to some extent, and that stems out of a series of events, some of which go back as far as the 1990s, where Langdell and his company, Gamers Edge, has been very aggressive in protecting their rights to the mark Edge or Gamer's Edge. So, I mean, we could talk. I mean, the next big question is what our issue here was this game that is going to be released, or maybe it's even a sequel to a game called The Mirror's Edge, and series of marks by that have been registered by the company Gamer's Edge, and they seem to be suggesting that they can challenge the use of Mirror's Edge. And it's been sort of a back and forth. There have been negotiations back and forth for over the last year, I think, on whether or not the parties could amicably agree to some sort of usage or licensure of the of the mark and game. And my understanding, based on the media reports, is that those completely fell through fairly recently, within the last couple of months. And interestingly, so EA and DICE, who is also one of the developers of this new game, Mirror's Edge, they had filed for registration for a trademark under Mirror's Edge. And just recently this month, they also filed a statement of express abandonment. So they chose to abandon the mark. And then following that, either prior to or maybe even sometime concurrently, these proceedings were also filed in order to challenge the validity of these three marks, based on the fact, I think, or at least on one of the facts, is that they're claiming that those marks were not actually in use in commerce at the time that they were registered, and for some reason that indicates fraud in registration, and therefore those marks should be invalidated.
Okay, that was
a great summary, Dave.
Yeah. What else do we have to talk about here? I mean, we've kind of outlined all of the bases.
So, the big underlying trademark claim here is whether or not Mirror's Edge then, even though that, let's just assume that Mirror's Edge was not expressly abandoned and they're still considering to go ahead and keep that name in the game, if the question is whether or not Edge Games could then challenge any such use of the phrase Mirror's Edge based on the registered marks that they do have, and obviously hinge on the analysis under trademark likelihood of confusion. So we could talk a little bit about likelihood of confusion and how you have trademark infringement under that, if you guys like.
Okay. Why don't you give us just a real quick rundown? We're running out of time for this story.
Yeah, sure. So there's several cases, and they have a variety of different names, and there's sort of these factors, and there are, depending on which case that you read, there's approximately 7 or 8 factors that are used by a court to determine whether or not there is some sort of probability of confusion, not just a mere possibility of confusion. They look to how strong the mark is, how strong the plaintiff marks is, and what is the degree of similarity between the marks, what's the proximity of the product or the goods in the marketplace. You know, if we're talking about a registered mark, that means if we're talking about a registered mark for computer games, if you're trying to sell consulting services and you want to call them, you know, edge consulting products or some other use of the word edge, they're not very close. So if you don't have proximate markets, it's not really grounds to find infringement. And you also look to a finding of actual confusion, which is the biggest one. You want to see that there is some sort of apparent actual confusion that occurs in the marketplace for the consumer looking to purchase the good. And also look a little bit to the defendant for adopting a mark that is or possibly allegedly similar to the plaintiff's mark. And then, of course, you also need to take a little bit of a market survey. You don't actually have to survey, but what is put before the court is some consideration to what's the level of sophistication by consumers and whether or not they would actually be confused by the similarity of the marks.
Okay, that was a great rundown. Just a quick note on that kind of analysis. There's recently been some hay made of an Apple suit. This was brought in Australia, and I'm not familiar with Australian copyright law. But essentially, a company there that sells produce named Woolworths changed their logo to look like a stylized W that kind of looks like an apple with a leaf coming out of the top. And Woolworths, while they sell apples and produce and food, registered the copyright to include things like electronics. And Apple was not happy about another company with an apple-like logo coming in. And
register the trademark, you should say. Sorry.
Yeah, registering the trademark for electronics, right. So, any last thoughts before we move on?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just want to bring to light really quickly here that some of the media reports have really continued to crucify Tim Landell and his company in the way that they've gone about protecting these marks. But I think that we have to step back and still recognize that these are protected marks. And once you have a validly registered trademark, as the trademark owner, you certainly have the ability to aggressively as you like to challenge other people's use of similar marks. And it's not, to me at least, it's not you have any games out there that are using all or part of a mark that's owned by the Edge Gamers company. And it's not such a surprise to me that they're going to aggressively protect the use of that word in the mark. Now, whether or not they, you know, that The fact that Edge Games has a mark, whether or not that gives them exclusive use to all titles with the word Edge in it, that's more for a court to decide and not myself. But I do think that it's not quite as crazy as people might think. The unfortunate side effect, though, is how independent game developers have been affected in using the mark or using phrases similar to mark to title their games.
Okay. Thank you for all that rundown and all that law, David.
That was exhausting.
Yeah, deep breaths. We're almost done. Our last story today is Werner versus Autodesk. The background behind this story is that Mr. Werner here sells stuff on eBay. He got his hands on a couple of copies of Autodesk, and he put them up on eBay. And Autodesk sent eBay a notice saying, this person can't sell them on eBay. We license these things. We don't actually sell them, so he's not licensed. These copies essentially are not licensed for resale. You should take them down, and you should suspend his account for a little while. And eBay obliged, and Werner said, hey, wait a second. This isn't fair. I bought these fair and square. I should be able to sell them. And sued Autodesk for declaratory judgment. This is something that we've mentioned before. You sue someone to prevent you from being sued. But it never works out in the end, because the first thing that the company does is sue you for whatever it was you were trying to get permission to do in the first place. But sorry?
The counterclaim against you in the case.
Right.
Yep, the technical term is counterclaim.
Yes.
So, rather, the legal term, not the technical term. I sense, I guess, in a blog called Technically Legal, we need to distinguish between our technical and legal terms.
Right. So he filed suit. Autodesk filed immediately to dismiss, and that was denied a few months ago, and the parties have finally moved on with the proceedings, gotten to a point called summary judgment, and they both filed motions for summary judgment, which essentially is saying, we've gotten to a point, we don't think there are any issues of material fact that have to be determined. You know, we've done depositions, we've submitted briefs, we think that based on the facts that we're not disputing, you know, here's the license, here's what I was trying to do, we think that the court can determine this entirely based on law. We don't need a jury trial. We don't need to bring in witnesses past this point. You can just, you know, decide it from here. Both parties filed motions for summary judgment, and the court denied Autodesk's motion, and they granted Werner's motion, and they found in favor of his right to be able to sell this software. And even They determine this, it's kind of a mixture between two things. The first is called the first sale doctrine, and the second is copyright misuse. And I guess we'll tackle those in order. So first off is first sale doctrine. Can one of you two give us a quick rundown of what the first sale doctrine is?
David, do you want to go for it?
I can take it. Yeah, sure. I can jump in. So the first sale doctrine is actually a limitation that's provided within the Copyright Act. And when you are the owner of a copyright, you have exclusive rights over the distribution of a copyrighted work. But after you've made that initial distribution, you say that after that in terms of distribution. So the classic example is when you buy a book from a bookstore, the author is getting some sort of royalties in the initial sale of that book. But he can't come after you, or she can't come after you, if you decide to resell the book as a used book, and you are allowed to freely distribute the book from there on.
Right, and this has gone so far, even at one point, I think it was a book publisher, put a little notice on the back of the book that says, you are only licensed to use this book. You do not have a right to resell the book. And the Supreme Court in that case said, that's absurd. It's a book. The person bought the book. They can sell the book if they want to. And this has been an issue as far as how first sale applies to computer software for some time, because we've all clicked those. I mean, they're called end user license agreements. It's the, you know, the terms of terms and conditions that you agree to when you install a piece of software. You know, the box that you have to click before the installer goes through. And this issue has been lingering in the background as to whether or not you're actually just getting a license to use it, or whether or not you've purchased a copy. You've been sold a copy. And there have been some cases that have come down on both sides of this issue, or rather on either side of this issue before then. And the court in this case tries to reconcile the two. Do they do a good job?
Yes, potentially. The problem, I think, these line of cases, if you want to boil this down to the key legal issue, it sort of always hinges on whether or not a have been granted the legal title to own a copy of a copyrighted protect or a copyright protected work, or whether or not you are merely granted some sort of license, which means we're basically renting it to you rather than selling it to you. And the problem with the distinct line of cases, because there are two of them and they have existed now for a while, always seems to depend on close readings of the facts and what the actual wording of the license is. So the cases are sometimes easily distinguishable and sometimes not, depending on the wording of the license and the entire context of how the product was sold to you, whether that was actually a sale, as we might classify it under the Uniform Commercial Code, or whether it was just a license.
Before we get into the specifics of the two lines of cases, it might be helpful to take a step back and just look at the facts. Basically, there's sort of this third-party CTA, which Werder bought the AutoCAD from, and his argument basically is that he's the owner of the software packages because the ownership was transferred from CTA, who Autodesk sold the package, the software to, and making them the owner. Autodesk's argument, in contrast, is that no. We've always been the owner. If you look at the end user license agreement that we include with our software, it says all title remains in Autodesk, no matter where you transfer the actual physical software around. So we've always been the owner. Therefore, the license agreement applies to you just as applied to CTA, and therefore you can't resell it without our permission.
Right. Thanks. Thanks for reeling us in too, Dominic.
So I guess the key part here is that the differences. The two lines come up with two different answers as to who owned the cases, depending on which line of cases you go with. There's one line of cases. David, go ahead.
Right. Well, there's one line of cases that basically said, well, it's more nuanced than that, actually. So sometimes what the courts will do is they look to the wording of the actual license, and they want to determine, based on the license and in conjunction with the context of how it was sold, whether or not this was an actual transfer of ownership of the work or whether it was actually a license. Sometimes what happens is in these licenses, and almost always in these licenses, you have the party that's trying to license the product is, he says in the agreement itself that this is a license. We are retaining the legal title to the property, and we are only licensing you. Some courts will actually look at the language of that, and they'll try to make a determination on whether or not this was really a license or whether it was a sale. And that's where the cases sort of split across. There's a number of policy reasons on why these licenses are overly restrictive, and they should not be read to be actual licenses, and instead they should be sales with restrictions or conditions attached to them. And that's sort of the basis of the split itself.
Okay, so in this case, I mean, there are obviously a lot of facts that were important in deciding this. Can you boil down, to the best that we can? This is not a very clear opinion. We'll post it. It's kind of rambling. It doesn't concentrate on any issue for a long time or in any depth. What do we think balanced the scales for the court here that made it rule one way or the other?
Well, as far as I can recall, the court basically declined to apply the line of cases that Autodesk wanted to apply to it, which were, of course, the line of cases that said, no, these are actually licenses. And that was the sort of the substance of the first summary judgment motion, which was granted in favor of Werner, the defendant or the guy that was attempting to sell the AutoCAD software itself.
Okay.
I gave you a little bit more specific. They went through the analysis that I just talked about, where they went through the caricature of the transaction and the license themselves and the license itself, and then based on that and based on a reading of the case law, they simply found in favor of Werner rather than Autodesk.
Okay. Any other comments on the first sale part of this case?
Well, some of the interesting policy arguments behind it are that some people believe that the Bell Doctrine is an express limitation within the Copyright Act, and if you try to usurp that limitation through by means of contract law, which is really what's happening here. We're talking about contract law. We're talking about licenses. You're trying to basically get around this limitation that is effectively imposed on all copyright holders through the Act. And you know, some of the policy considerations include things like, well, this provision of the Act was meant to encourage the secondary for used sale, you know, sales of used items like books and that sort of stuff. The opposing side is, of course, is that the Copyright Act is still not very well adapted to certain forms of technology, and it would open up all sorts of new avenues if you would allow people to do whatever they liked with the software after it was initially sold. And of course, the companies that develop software are have a very strong opinion about these things should be just licensed and why they should always retain all of the rights that go on beyond that initial source, instead of, you know, that this is a legal, this is a transfer of legal title.
Right, and the court had this to say about the policy arguments. Quote, there's much more to say about such policy debates, but the court's decisions today are not based on any policy judgment. Congress is both constitutionally and institutionally suited to render judgments on policy. Courts generally are not.
Right.
So I think very, very prudently the court recognized that there were policy issues here and dodged them to the best that they could, because when courts make policy, generally bad things result. And, you know, we're seeing that problem crop up with the Google Books settlement, where, you know, everyone's kind of piling on, and it's getting to the point where this is going to be a very big decision one way or the other, and it's probably not a decision that should rest within the authority of, you know, that one judge.
Not to belabor this or anything, but you know, I think it's especially problematic for courts to decide policy issues like this when there is an actual split in jurisdictions. And that's sort of what had been fueling part of this and why the court decided to include that language. Like, this isn't so much a policy decision as it is a reading into the case law itself.
Right. I mentioned earlier that there was a copyright misuse portion here. I misspoke. Werner did raise copyright misuse, but the problem with copyright misuse is that it's a defense to infringement, and it didn't really apply in this case, and the court declined to rule on it, and Mr. Werner agreed that there was really no need to go further into it at this stage. Do we have any other thoughts on this before we close it out for the day?
Well, actually, copyright misuse has been accepted as an affirmative right, at least, I think, in the Ninth Circuit. But in most of the other circuits out there, it is just a defense, rather than some sort of affirmative right that you could, you know, create a legal remedy for that you could sue on in court.
Yeah, well, this was in the Ninth Circuit. This was in the District of Washington.
I'm sorry.
Seattle, Washington.
Yeah, the reason misuse didn't... The reason misuse didn't matter here is because he won on the copyright claim and basically found that Autodesk copyright didn't prevent him from reselling his packages. Therefore, since the copyright wasn't being violated by reselling, there was no way for misuse to apply.
Right, and I'm going to put a caveat on what Dave has said in that while it may have been accepted as an affirmative cause of action in one case, that's one case in a circuit that is generally held to be presumptively wrong.
it was two or three cases, and then there are also in the same district, in the state of California. So we're looking at district level cases, not circuit level cases that have found this. By the way, so that's
okay.
I misspoke when I said Ninth Circuit, but those districts are within the Ninth Circuit, of course. There's still a split between some of the districts too, and I can recall at least two. The most recent being the SciStar case, where they have accepted some sort of claim for copyright misuse. But you're correct, though.
Isn't the SciStar case a declaratory judgment case, though, where they're trying to argue that the license isn't applicable because of copyright misuse on the part of
part of Apple? No. Well, it's nuanced again because there are multiple claims going back and forth. But the copyright misuse claim in that was actually part of a counterclaim. SciStar didn't bring a declaratory judgment action in that case, as far as I recall. Apple initiated the suit, and there was a series of counterclaims that went amended several times. And upon, I think, about April of 2009, there was a decision that came down on those motions that said, yes, you can go ahead with a counterclaim based on copyright misuse.
Okay, well, we're just about at time, so I'm going to wrap it up. We'd like to thank you all for listening. You can visit us at our website, www.technicallylegal.com. You could send your comments, questions, concerns, or suggestions to podcast@technicallylegal.org. And I think I said .com earlier. I meant .org, technicallylegal.org. So signing off, I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Ravier.
And I'm David O'Brien.
Thanks for listening.